Vineyardum, because I always sing that. I'm used to singing Vineyard of the Lord, and it's in the kingdom there at the end of the verse, and it always comes out Vineyardum. Anyway, these are the kinds of things that I think about. Listen, I'm very thankful again to be with you and back this evening. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here and to share what was truly a blessing in my life, to be able to go over into China and work with some amazing people there. Thanks for the hospitality this afternoon. We had a very enjoyable time over at the Byers. I always get a warm welcome when I'm with you folks, and I just appreciate it so much. I'm glad that Robin could be with me today, and so some of you had an opportunity to meet her, and it's certainly been an encouragement for both of us. So we talked about the culture of China. We talked about the church and the struggles that they are facing. And so tonight, I want to talk about what we taught in China. And, in Acts 8th chapter, the disciples went everywhere preaching the word. And that's what we're doing whenever we take the gospel someplace. We're taking it wherever we're going. And I felt it necessary to begin by talking about what we taught Christians there, people that have been converted, the ones that you saw pictures of this morning. And I don't want to talk, I don't want to teach the lessons themselves. I just want to give you an idea of what we taught. I'll spend more time towards the end of the lesson, and by towards the end, I mean shortly after the beginning for the rest of the night. A prototypical lesson, I suppose, of what we presented in China. I'm going to be skipping huge sections of what we would go through because those sessions take 2, 3, 4 hours, and you're not interested in that, even though you have much more comfortable seats than they had. And so I'll just kind of hit the highlights on that. But while I promise that it's not going to be as long, I think it'll be just as interesting for you. So let's talk about teaching the saints in China first of all. And Jesus, in the Great Commission in Matthew, he said, go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And then verse 20 says, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. So after making disciples, which is covered in the first part of Matthew 28:19, which means you're sharing with them the gospel of Jesus Christ. You're bringing them to believe that Jesus is, in fact, the Christ, the Son of God. And then you take them disciples that you've made and you baptize them. That's basically what Jesus said. Make disciples, then baptize them disciples. And then after you've done that, after you've brought them to Christ, then you begin to teach them all things whatsoever I've commanded you. So when you're making converts, you don't have to teach them about the church or elderships or why we partake of the Lord's Supper every week. And bring them to Christ and then begin going that. So that's what we do there. And so, as I said, we bring them to faith in Christ, that he's the Son of God. And we went all through that. So now what happens when you've done that and you've baptized all these people, you have a lot of babies on your hands. People that need to be taught, people that need to learn about walking and living a life that is actually worthy of the Lord and trying to be like him and become like him. In fact, I think that ought to be the goal of every disciple, and Jesus said this as well, that we be like the Master. And I use this often in my preaching. People ought to look at us as we've been around them for a while and say, you know, you remind me of someone. Oh, I know who it is. You remind me of Jesus. That's the way it ought to be, if we're disciples, if we're living correctly. And so the topics that we're going to be talking to them about are numerous. We obviously talk to them about worship and the need for worship and the importance of worship and the importance of individual worship, not just in the collective, but when you're sad, you pray, according to James. When you're happy, you sing songs. How many of you do that, by the way, when you're happy in the car or at home, to sing a hymn? It's what God wants you to do. It's how he wants you to express that. And there's all kinds of topical studies. Besides, I skipped the spot there. You know, we take them through Acts. We show them what the early church was like, which I will tell you, I think more than any other group I've ever been around, the people in China can relate to being in Acts. Brand new Christians in a pagan world and trying to figure out how to live this life in this particular environment. And then topical studies. And it's just amazing, you know, when we just open it up to brand new Christians that are coming and say, just bring your questions. How many of them have to do with work? Do we have to work? What kind of employees ought we to be? And how should we react to our bosses? What about being citizens? What about being citizens in such an oppressive government? How do we act? What are we supposed to do? And being neighbors. I had a whole class one time. People said, all we want to hear about is working. What does it mean to work? And taking them through that whole process. Obviously, being godly parents, being what it's going to be like for them to be spouses. So very few people. Two people asked me today, where's all the kids in your slides? They don't exist because they're not married. People aren't married. As I talked about earlier, there's a lot more females than there are males, than there are females. Do you think that females could have their pick of the litter? But they're not going to marry anybody that's not a Christian. And they're not going to marry anybody that's not a Christian that's not committed. And of all the people that I've had contact with, I only know of two couples that came out of that married each other. And I don't know if they have any kids yet. And if they do, they probably had one. So, you know, it's just children are scarce. We go through Old Testament studies, talk about the law, talk about covenants, and talking about the other books of the New Testament. And depending on the audience that I'm dealing with, in every case, and their education, sometimes they speak pretty good English. And so you can get through the English with them. But some of them do not speak English at all, especially if they've come into the area from Western China where they didn't get much education and they're there for jobs. They're needing to be, it's needing to be translated to them. And of course, then that becomes a pretty tedious process for them. And that's where I had in my notes, I knew I was going to say at some point in time, where you become kind of a walking thesaurus, trying to say what you're saying in four different ways until the translator can say, oh, I know that concept. And I can share that with him. So while I was in China, I taught lessons on the characters of the Bible. We just would go through specific characters, how to train up a child, what life in Christ looks like, that it's to be abundant, it's to be joyful, it's to be viewed with hope, and marriage. I did four different lessons on the book of Philemon, one on each chapter, or each section. There's only one chapter in Philemon, but four different views of that one book, and then a good bit of study on prayer. Listen, there are people that go over there. It's almost what they do. I know two different individuals that go over to China four times a year, and they go over for 3 and 4 weeks at a time, and what they're doing over there is just teaching, constantly teaching, and teaching groups like what I showed you this morning. As we mentioned as well, now there's families that are agreeing to move. And the one place where they're moving is over in Nanning, where I spent some time. And they're living there, and they're teaching English as a second language, and they've got a home there, and their kids are being educated there, and they may be being homeschooled. I wouldn't doubt that. But they're making these relationships and having the opportunity to teach people. So I just wanted to make sure that you understood that a lot of our work over there is not just evangelism, it's also edification and building up the saints and building up the church that's there. So that brings us to the main section here, teaching the untaught in China. And again, as we've been talking about, you have to understand the culture here. Many of the people that you're going to be meeting and speaking to have not known anything about the existence of God. They've never heard of God. It's never entered their minds that there is a God. And I know that's very difficult for us to imagine. I mean, we don't even, the Pledge of Allegiance and a lot of our patriotic songs and on our coins, in God we trust, you have a, at least a brushing acquaintance with God in our society. That is not the case in China. If there is a word that describes them perfectly with regards to that, it is ignorant. They have no knowledge of God or even that he exists. And of course, if there is no knowledge of God, then there's also no knowledge of this. They haven't got a clue about the Bible. And so that leaves you with some challenges, because how are you going to present and bring them to Christ if you have to start all the way back there with their notion or their understanding that there is no God? So where do we begin? Acts the 8th chapter and verse 35, when Philip was with the Ethiopian there, it said that he began at that text and began to teach to him about Jesus. And so as you are approaching even people in your own circle, in your own world that you're in, you have to begin where they are, wherever place that they are. And so we have to start off with presenting them with the possibility of the existence of God. Don't ever think that you'll be able to prove that God exists. Those that please God are going to come to him not on the basis of knowledge, but on the basis of faith. We believe that there's a God. My faith is so strong that I can say that I know there's a God, but it's still faith. It's still faith. It will always be faith. God has not overwhelmed us. He's given us enough to make it logical and make us accept it and believe it. But as the scripture says, no one has seen God. And so we come to him on the basis of faith. And again, I can't overemphasize this enough. You're trying to get them to accept a notion that they've never even conceived of, never heard. Nobody's ever told them about this. So let's begin with bringing them to God. And again, we're going to begin with what they have been taught already, the things that they know already. So we're going to begin with the universe. They can see that. And this next slide, you're going to think is kind of corny maybe, or not respectful or what have you. But the Cynthia that I told you about this morning, who was my translator and guide when I was in Shanghai, this was the slide that got her to thinking. And so here's this cartoon, poorly drawn, I still think, but there it is. And so up in the corner, once I was a tadpole so long and thin, then I was a froggy with my tail tucked in. Then I was a monkey in a tropical tree, and now I'm your biology teacher with my college degree. And so that's the evolution from something in the ocean that crawled out on the ground and became a monkey, became a man. And she had never considered that in a short time. This other was a circular reasoning. I know my bone is 5 million years old because my friend, the paleontologist here, told me the ground I found it in is 5 million years old. And the paleontologist says, and I know my ground is 5 million years old because my friend, the evolutionist, told me his fossil is 5 million years old. So they both are supporting each other and neither one knows which is which. So there is a leap of logic that you have to take to believe in evolution. There's a leap of logic as well in faith in God. And what we're trying to point out is exactly this. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. Listen, the universe speaks a universal language everybody understands. You don't have to know Chinese or English in order to understand the message of the universe, which is God's glory. I can't remember. I think this is the NIV. I like that the heavens are his handiwork. Handiwork is what women do with knitting needles and they're watching TV or doing something else. when God created the universe, it was just like this, and there it was. He didn't break a sweat to do it. And so we're trying to point out to them the magnitude, the immensity of the universe, as well as the design. And some of you may have seen these slides before. We use them over there. And so here's the Earth in our solar system with four other planets, Venus and Mars and Mercury and Pluto. So you can just get a kind of an idea of the size of the Earth with relation to the other planets. And then we bring in the bigger planets, Jupiter and Saturn, and there's Uranus and Neptune. And you can see the Earth down there in the bottom left. And then those other planets with Pluto way down there in the size. So this is just the planets in our solar system. I guess this is outdated. Did Pluto ever come back as a planet? I still love Pluto. We're going to keep him. And so here's the sun. And here's the sun compared to Jupiter. And can you see, can you still make out the Earth and how small the Earth is in comparison to the sun? And so the sun is huge. You say, wow, that's huge. Well, here's the sun on the far left there. Your left is good. And then here's three other stars, Sirius, Pollux, and Arcturus. Stars that are larger than our sun. And then we find some big stars like Betelgeuse and Antares. And you can't even see the sun because on this picture, the sun is the size of one pixel compared to these other stars. I mean, just try to get your mind around how huge and immense the universe is, and all of these stars are in our galaxy. And there are 100 billion galaxies. It's amazing. And when you're made to see that, you can see that it's just gigantic. And you can go into other things. You can talk about the fact that everything in the universe is spreading apart. In fact, it's the firmament. It's spreading apart. The weird thing about it is that they have determined that the spreading out of the universe, that it's picking up speed. It ought not to be picking up speed. If the first and second law of thermodynamics is correct, it ought to be slowing down. So why is it picking up speed? That doesn't fit our laws. And so it's just an amazing thing. So the next thing that we would ask then is, so is the universe here by accident or is it here by design? Was it created or did it just happen? And so we talk about the fact that evolution and a belief in God are both matters of faith. Evolution provides us with some things. For instance, nothing to look forward to. They were here by accident. There's no God, and everything is just physical. It's the materialistic view of life. Everything is made out of matter. On the other hand, faith in God, there is hope, and there is design, and that God exists. And not only is there physical, there is a spiritual element to life. And so then you ask, okay, so what's more reasonable? What's more reasonable to believe? And so at that point, I would launch into a discussion of evolution. I'm going to skip that with you. But here's where it got fun for me. This picture is me with five medical students in Guangzhou. And from back to front, so further back to me, there's an endocrinology student and a pulmonary student and a pharmacology student and a cardiology student and a urology student. They're all studying medicine at the university there. And so I asked them, and I think I used a camera, but I'll use my phone this time. I asked them, I said, is this here by accident or is it here by design? I said, do people, are they out digging in the ground and say, hey, over here, I found some galaxy 10s, you know, or picking those up. And the guy says, no. Dig a little further over there. There's iPhone 11s over here, and this is a much better place. I said, is that how that works? Do they just dig these out? Do they just mine them out of the ground? Is it here by accident or by design? Oh, by design. By design. Let me back up here. I think I went too far forward. And so then I take off my glasses and I point to my eye. Is this here by accident or by design? And every one of those medical students said, oh, just happened. It just happened. So then I just spent some time with them talking about the eyeball and how, you know, how many colors it can see, how much more sophisticated the lens is in my eye than it is on the camera. I said, my eye is self-cleaning. You know, it takes care of it. It takes care of all the problems that would happen in there and can focus immediately and can tell depth and all of that. Listen, when they heard that, for the first time in their lives, that the eye was designed and that there's a possibility of a God, a creator, a designer, it's just like you could just see the windows open up to a whole new way of looking at life. I mean, it was amazing to have a completely different perspective and possibility than they had ever been taught before. To see that look on their face, I wouldn't trade that for anything. So, let's say we succeeded in bringing them to God, and so now we need to bring them to the Bible. And because in the Bible is where God has revealed himself. You know, when I was growing up, I was thinking, okay, this is God's revealed will. That's what I was always taught. It's not just God's revealed will. God's revealed himself here. I find out what kind of God he is and what his character is and what he wants for us. And so it's a revelation of that. And so again, the question is, so if that's the case, where do I start again? Because I have to start where they are. And fortunately for us, we can start with their language. This is a great way to approach the Chinese and Japanese, for that matter, as well. It's used in Japan. Because the common held opinion is that Christianity is a Western religion. The premier of China, the reason he's cracking down on Christianity, because he doesn't want Western influence. And what this shows is that the Bible and faith in God is not Occidental. It is not Western. It is Oriental. It's Asian. That it comes from their own culture. And the Middle East is Oriental. Even west of Jerusalem is a land that was referred to as Asia what? Asia Minor. Why do they call it Asia Minor? Because it's Asia. Okay? It's Asian. And so that immediately brings a comfort level to your students who are afraid, and rightfully so, that they're turning their back on their culture. In fact, many Chinese people that we have talked to who have become Christians, when they go home for that King Ming celebration, just to be with family, not to celebrate. I'll tell you what, that's a big thing for them, because should we go? Because the purpose is to worship our ancestors, and we don't want to do that. We don't believe in that, but they want to see their family. So that's, you know, they have their own levels of whether they should celebrate particular holidays or not. But when they get there and their family tells, they find out they're Christian, we hear you are now Christian. You no longer love your family or your parents anymore, huh? And so, well, we know that what it is, you eat potato. Well, potato is not an Asian food. Potato is a Western food. And so to say you eat potato is a slam. It's intended to be a slam. You're a Western person. And so going through this and showing them the Bible in their own language shows to them that that's their roots too. That's their culture as well. So what I want to talk to you about some tonight here in the middle here is kanji. And kanji is the ancient language of China and Japan. The Chinese language is the longest continually used language on the face of the earth. They've been speaking this for 4,500 years. And which, if you do the timeline, will take you back to just about the time of the Tower of Babel. And what you're going to want to do then is take them through their history and show them the history of their people and what they believed in those years. And so here is 2019. I should change that to 20. That last year was the year of the pig. I don't have to figure out what the 20 is. So you go right there in the middle, right before 500 BC, 551, 600 BC, 621 BC is where you have Buddha and Lao Tzu, who did the Taoism, and Confucius, which is Confucianism. It's right there at about 500 BC. So their time, their history goes back to 2500 BC, 4,500 years ago. So the question is, what did your people believe during this 2,000 years of history? Because for most people, they think, well, it's Buddha on. You know, that's China. But you have 2,000 years of history prior to that. So what did you believe during that time? Well, interestingly enough, theirs was a worship of Shangdi. And Shangdi is the same as Tian that I spoke to you about this morning. They believed in Shangdi, which is one God. One God. China's earliest historian was a man by the name of Sima Qian, and he lived 135 to 86 BC. And he wrote of a king named Huangdi, who was the Yellow Emperor. And the Yellow Emperor lived from 2500 to 2400 BC, which was at the very beginning of the Chinese people. He is said to be the originator and father of the Han nation, H-A-N. And he built an altar in Taishan in the mountain of Shandong province, which is just south of present-day Beijing, to worship Shangdi. By the way, before you say, well, that's an idolatrous thing, no, that's what Abraham did. Abraham built altars and worshiped Yahweh. And that's basically what you're seeing this man do. He's building an altar and he's worshiping the one God who is Shangdi. And he also recorded the comments, this Siam Queen, recorded the comments of a Han Dynasty scholar. And this is what he wrote. Shangdi is another name for Tian. The spirits do not have two lords. There's just one. One God. And listen, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. That's what the Chinese were teaching just as they left the Tower of Babel. There is a song found in the collections of the Ming Dynasty, and I'll have the whole song up here, and I'm going to read it for you, but I want you to think, as I'm reading that, I want you to say, that sounds familiar. And think where you thought you heard that. Of old, in the beginning. Now listen, this is from Chinese literature. Of old, in the beginning, there was the great chaos without form and dark. The five planets had not begun to revolve, nor the two lights to shine. In the midst of it, there existed neither forms nor sound. You, O spiritual sovereign, came forth in your sovereignty and first did divide the impure from the pure. You made heaven, you made earth, you made man. All things became alive with reproducing power. Does that sound like anything that you've read before? Like the first chapter of Genesis? That's from ancient China. That's from long before Moses ever lived. That was written. The light from the darkness, the land from the water, creating all life, plant and animals, fish, birds, and beasts, creating man, creating all those things with reproducing power. 4,500 years ago, the Chinese were worshiping Shangdi, the creator and all-powerful God, the God who was most high. That's their heritage. That's who they worshiped. The exact same God that we worship. And many times they have no idea that that was the case. And so now you've brought them even deeper into their culture and said, this is where you come from. This is what your ancestors worshipped. It wasn't Buddhism, and it wasn't Taoism, and it wasn't Confucianism. This is 2,000 years before that. And so now we take them, having taken them through their history, now we're going to show them from their own language, from kanji, the events in the Bible from Genesis chapter 1 to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel, and that's when all of mankind was dispersed. And that's when the shared history of all mankind ended. They had their own culture and history. And so, as we said, kanji developed out of the Tower of Babel. And when I first started presenting this, I didn't realize it as much as I am realizing it now. Who is the one who created languages? God did. Listen, I'll tell you, if you want to do a Google search, if you love doing that kind of thing, just Google the origin of languages and find out how linguists are just so stumped. Why are there so many languages? Why are there so many dialects in languages? And why are they so diverse? And of course, we understand why that is. So this is what I would share with a Chinese student. And I start with the Tower of Babel. The time is right. The place is right. The location is right. And it's in the west there, around probably modern day Iraq somewhere. And when God scattered the people, they scattered and went everywhere, and they went in all directions. And the ancestors of the Chinese went east. And you need to understand that. Let me back up just a little bit. That when I show you these kanji symbols and the kanji language, these people, have been writing, they've been memorizing these kanji symbols their whole lives. They know how to write the kanji for a particular word, and they know the different strokes and everything, but they just learn it as a whole. We have a member in our congregation who is native Japanese, and when I went through this with her, She's just astounded at it. She said, I learned all that. I learned all those, how to write those words, but I didn't know that they were made up of several different things that stood for something else. And they don't either. The Chinese people's mouths just drop open when they go through this. So shared history is what makes communication possible, shared experiences. And so if I say something's hot, you've experienced what's hot, and so you know what hot is. And when I did this class in Bremerton, we went through 41 different kanji symbols. I'm only going to give you, I think I have 8 different varieties. Maybe there's 11 altogether. But we covered the kanji symbols that cover creation, the flood, the Tower of Babel itself, and the whole concept of salvation that is there as well. So I'm going to just give you some samples, but you can see here that the Chinese, just as a part of their culture, that they migrated from Iran, Iraq to China. And so they walked from the west to where they are. And the fact that kanji even carries with it the fact of migration, that they haven't always been in China forever, is a big step forward. So I want to give you these symbols, and we'll look at them. The first one I'm going to show you is west. And so to make the kanji symbol for rest, for west, there are 3 radicals that go together for this. Number one is the one. And so that's how you would write one in kanji. It's just a swoop to the right there. And then you would add the kanji for person. And you can see it's like a person walking. It's kind of interesting as well to see how these have evolved through time to where they are now. And then you also add the kanji for an enclosed garden, where there is a garden. And when you put them together, you put all of those three symbols together, that is the kanji symbol for West. If you're going to read it as one, West is one man's garden. One man's garden. Can you think of anybody that had one man's garden? It's Eden. God formed the man and put him in the garden. Interestingly enough, this is still used, this concept is still used in Japanese funerals. When a man dies, and the Japanese have a view that the spirit, in fact, they mourn for a year because they believe the spirits of men are still wandering around. But they will come out at the end of the year, and they'll call the man's name. Let's say this Japanese person's name is Joe, just because I don't think there's probably any Joes here. And they'll take a long pole, and they'll point it towards the west, and they will say, John, or Joe, go west. And they'll point that way. And the reason they're wanting Joe to go west, because that's where paradise is. And if you look on the map, you'll recognize Eden was west of China and Japan. Go back to the one man's garden. Go back to where you began. So then the second one that we'll look at is migrate, which again is a concept that it's very difficult for people to understand, but they have the word migrate in their minds, and it's because their ancestors walked a long time and a long distance from Babel, from the Tower of Babel, in the West. And there are four different kanji symbols that make up the word migrate. The first one is the kanji radical for great. You add the kanji symbol for long ago, and then add west, because that's what we just talked about. And then you add the kanji symbol for walk. And when you put them all together, that's the word migrate. To migrate means that you originally were in the west and you came to where you are now. You walked a long distance from the west. And again, we see that. You can see that in the Bible story. So now let's look at the word beginning. And actually, there are three different kanji symbols for the word beginning. And the first one has two parts. It is the kanji symbol for two, and then the kanji symbol for person. And that is beginning. Two people is the word for beginning. And so part of their ancient language is the beginning of man. Two people, male and female. The second word for beginning has three parts. The first one is the kanji symbol for woman. The second one is for mouth. It's different than garden. It has a little things in the side. And the third one is secret thing. And when you put them all together, that is beginning. A woman with a secret thing in her mouth. And that's the beginning of sin. When she took the thing that she wasn't supposed to have and put it in her mouth in Genesis chapter 3. The third symbol for beginning, and listen, we have different words for that mean the same thing. But it's very interesting to see the pictographs and the things that they've chosen to put together to form this word. It has two parts. The first one is the kanji symbol or radical for clothing and knife. Clothing and knife. And when you put them together, that's beginning. And of course, when they sinned, what did God provide for them? Provided clothing. Made from what? Animal skins. You think the animals just kind of unzipped them and stepped out of them? No, they had to be removed. They were sacrificed. And so that's the beginning of grace, is clothing and a knife. Now, you and I know the Bible story, and so we can see that readily. They do not. They have not. But when you go to the scriptures and show them, right there is your word beginning. Here's the concept. Here's the thing that that gave the notion for this word and what it means right there. And it's astounding to them. It gets better. Here's the word forbid. Forbid has two kanji radicals as well. Let me turn the page here and get where I'm supposed to be. The first radical is two trees. That's pretty easy to see. In fact, if you ever get it, you get something, you buy a Sony or something, and it's got the instruction in the back, and sometimes it's in kanji. Just kind of, I like to glance through there, see how many things I can recognize, and sometimes I see trees. You'll see this one probably. So you have the tree, and where would those trees be, do you suppose? In Eden, one would be the tree of life, and the other one would be the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the second radical is to express or command. And you put those together, express or command, with two trees, and that's the word forbid. God had commanded for them not to eat the fruit of one of those trees. And in fact, if you eat the forbidden one, you lose the other one. If you mistake and take the one that you shouldn't have, then you lose them both. So it's a two-tree proposition in being forbidden. I think that this kanji is found like in post offices in Japan on their grass, where you're not supposed to go on it. It's forbid. Don't step on our grass. They're still used today. Covet. Covet is also made of two kanji radicals. One is woman. We've already seen that one. The second one is also, we've seen, is two trees. Here's where, and I've skipped all of the kanjis that have to do with Satan and tempter and all of that, but here's where Satan succeeded in tempting the woman and getting her desire both the trees. She wanted the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. The question that I would ask you is, why is a woman and two trees, why when you put those two things together do you get the word covet? Outside of a context of the Bible story, where would you ever come up with that? And I suggest you never would. And yet, there it is, as plain as can be. And again, very impressive to the Chinese. They would look at that and they'd say, that's covet. And then they'd say, do you see what makes up covet? And you say, see, there's the woman and there's two trees. And here's, read Genesis 3. And you say, that's our language right there. And they will see that. So let's look at naked. And I've got two different words for naked. And the first one has two parts. One is a person. And the other is a tree with fruit. And so if you put a person in a tree with fruit, that's naked. Why? Because when they ate the fruit of the tree, they knew they were naked. Now, again, I just want you to know, this is 4,500 years old. This far predates the book of Genesis by 1,000 years. And again, you and I know that. Second word for naked also has two parts. This time it's clothing and the fruit of the tree. And again, we see that story in Genesis 3. And again, these are kanji words that are still used in China today. The last one that I will share with you is one of my favorites, and that's ship. And ship has three parts. The first is the radical for eight, the number eight. And then the radical for a mouth. And then the radical for a boat. And when you put those together, it's ship. I think it's important that we just have a radical for boat, that we see boat there. And so you have a boat. Well, how am I going to express the idea that we have a big boat? I mean a big boat, a ship. What's the biggest ship that we have had in our shared history from before the Tower of Babel? Well, that would be the Ark. And how many people were on that? There were eight mouths on that. On that ship. There are eight souls that were there. And so even their word ship has Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 in it. Now, as we go through these with our Chinese students and we read the text, they discover all of a sudden that the Bible is not a Western book, but rather, in fact, it is what it claims to be. It is the Word of God. And so from there, having convinced them that there's a God, or getting them to the point that they believe it and believing that this is God's Word, then we start to bring them to Christ and lead them to Christ. And having established all of that, we can talk about the scheme of redemption. And so we'll go through a study of God's promises, the promise that God made in the cursing of Adam and Eve and the serpent, and then coming down to Abraham and the promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David, and come right on through down to Christ. And then we talk about the life of Christ and the death of Christ. And I will tell you, I didn't have this experience, but a friend of mine did. They were going through the story of the life of Christ and talking about all the way through his trials and the fact that he died, that they put him to death. And then they opened the next page and talked about the resurrection, and these women are just crying, "He live! He live!" Just the joy that he wasn't dead anymore. And the joy of the gospel. And then expressing to them, you know, what they need to do to be saved. I will tell you that if there's an advantage to evangelizing people in China over the United States, is you don't have to unteach religious prejudices, because they don't have any. It's a little bit more time consuming because you have to bring them so far. But they can open their Bibles, and they will. They'll open their Bibles, and you don't have any arguments with them about baptism or I mean, it's just right there, and they see it and they want it. They want it right then, and they're willing to do so. So I will tell you that our success varies from trip to trip. We didn't have 41 conversions the first time I went. We did the last time that I went, but my friend who's been over there, was over there this last year, had zero. And so it just depends. And sometimes the fields are white, and sometimes they're not so white. Sometimes, again, as we're looking at the way things are done now, you just don't have the opportunity to teach as much. And so they're focusing on the Christians that are there and equipping them for the work of ministry and getting them to go out. As I said, the times are changing. The church in Bowling Green is willing to train and support people who would be willing to go over there and spend a couple of years in China. I think they advertised, I think they put it out on Facebook or something. They're looking, they're actively seeking people. I think that this is great because it provides stability and you have those close relationships. And if it was 40 years ago, I'd be on my way. If it was before Robin and I had children, or Nathaniel and Megan were tiny, I would be so willing to go and do that. And what an experience that would be, and an opportunity. And listen, as some of you young people, especially those of you that wanted this, put that in the back of your mind. That's a possibility for you. They want young married couples, they want families to go over. And I think that's going to be an ongoing thing that they're going to be doing. So if you want more information about that, by the time you get older to do it, and I'm still alive, call me. I will point you that way. So I hope that today's has given you a little bit of insight into the work of spreading the gospel in China, a little bit of information about the churches there and the Christians there and what they're facing. And I hope that you will, as you have done today, continue to pray for them and pray for that work and pray for the people that are there. God's going to be doing amazing things, I think, in China, as he's doing in India and Ethiopia and other places where people are going. And I've just been privileged to be a part of this. And so, again, I thank you for the opportunity to come and share that. And we'll invite, we'll offer the invitation, because it's a good and grand custom that we have. And if you have some need that you need to express to the congregation, or prayers that you want, or you want to become a child of God, then make your way to the front and let us help you with that while we stand and sing.